But I think what we kind of forgot with that is the other sort of not opposite, but necessary counterpoint, which is actually everyone. I want to be the
Hi, this is Alana from Sauk Hill. I'm the host of There There on WGXC Acre, Hudson, and Catskill. Radio for open ears.
You see Lion, the king of beasts.
Music from elsewhere and beyond.
Huge elephant trumpet across the plains.
Imaginary soundtracks to unmade foreign films.
And there are rhinos. Those craggy creatures surviving from a bygone age.
Snack Point Charlie. Hosted by Jeff Economy. Every first Wednesday from 10 p.m. to midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM. WGXC.org.
From Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival shelter today.
Wavefarm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of J. Johannes Freibel Parker of Ravenna, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC. Like good old tap water. Just turn it on and get it.
Juneteenth and July 4th highlight America's historic contradictions. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Two consecutive federal holidays, Juneteenth and Independence Day, highlight the sweep of American history, marking the birth of the nation on July 4th and on June 19th, the liberation of the last group of enslaved people in the United States at the end of a devastating civil war. Independence Day commemorates the day in 1776 when the text of the Declaration of Independence was agreed upon by the Continental Congress. Juneteenth is a compression of June 19th, the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Texas were finally freed with the arrival of the Union Army in Galveston, 2 months after the end of the Civil War and over 2 years after President Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. While these two holidays are celebratory, they afford an opportunity to reflect upon and hopefully to address this nation's crimes and contradictions. Take, for example, the most iconic statue in the United States, the Statue of Liberty. Formerly named Liberty Enlightening the World, the statue was a gift from France to the United States. The idea of the statue dates back to 1865.
Originally conceived by Edouard de Laboulaye, a French abolitionist who conceived of the idea of the Statue of Liberty and giving it to the United States as a gift, that it was originally conceived as an idea to celebrate the end of the Civil War and to celebrate abolition.
Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, explained on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. He went on to describe a little-known feature of the statue, her shackles.
The original conception of the statue actually had Lady Liberty breaking shackles, like a pair of broken shackles on her wrists to symbolize the end of slavery. And over time, it became very clear that that would not have the sort of wide mainstream support of people across the country, obviously this having been just not too long after the end of the Civil War, so there were still a lot of fresh wounds. And so they shifted the meaning of the statue to be more about a sort of inclusivity, more about the American experience, the American project, the American promise, the promise of democracy, and sort of obfuscated the original meaning to the point where even the design changed. And so they replaced the shackles with a tablet and the torch, and then put the shackles very subtly, sort of underneath her robe. And you can but the only way you can see them, these broken chains, these broken links, are from a helicopter or from an airplane.
The statue sits atop a massive pedestal, blocking the view of Lady Liberty's feet to pedestrians below. The statue was to be unveiled in 1876 for the U.S. centennial, but construction was delayed. By the October 28, 1886 unveiling, much had changed from when de la Boulaye conceived of the statue in 1865. Yes, slavery had ended, but so had Reconstruction, the rebuilding of the war-torn South intended to empower the newly freed black population. Instead, the system of segregation and racist terror that would become known as Jim Crow was being instituted. Meanwhile, women were still excluded from most aspects of economic and political life. The New York City Woman Suffrage Association rented a steamer to protest Lady Liberty's unveiling, calling the use of the female form in a country where they had no political rights, quote, a gigantic lie, a travesty, and a mockery, unquote. Their protest disrupted the unveiling, including a keynote address by politician and businessman Chauncey Depew. His speech promoted democratic ideals, but also denounced, quote, anarchists and bombs, and declared, quote, those who come to disturb our peace and dethrone our laws are aliens and enemies forever, unquote. The statue's unveiling occurred just over 5 months after the Haymarket incident in Chicago, when a rally for the 8-hour workday was disrupted by a bomb. The blast and subsequent police gunfire killed 7 police officers and at least 4 civilians, injuring many more. Several key Chicago labor movement leaders were tried and executed following the massacre, ushering in an era of violence against labor organizing that would last decades. The history of social progress in the United States is complex, interwoven, and often bloody.
We don't fully understand and account for this history that actually wasn't that long ago, that in the scope of human history was only just yesterday, then we won't fully understand how our contemporary landscape of inequality today, we won't understand how slavery shaped the political, economic, and social infrastructure of this country.
It was Emma Lazarus's poem New Colossus, commissioned by Joseph Pulitzer to raise funds for the statue's pedestal, that forever linked Lady Liberty to immigration, with the line, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, unquote. For many of the 12 million immigrants arriving at Ellis Island from 1892 to 1954, the statue was their first sight of their new home. Now in 2024, the state of Texas, the first state to institute Juneteenth as a holiday, has deployed its National Guard and other armed agents to deter and deport asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. And President Biden has joined the anti-immigrant fervor, shutting down the border to asylum seekers. If Lady Liberty, torch in hand and broken shackles at her feet, could shed tears, she'd be doing so now. Tears of sorrow, yes, but also tears of joy for the movements fighting for liberty, enlightening the world. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Adelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
You gotta try something.
I got a job at the radio station.
Oh, great, that place. It's dark and dirty and has, like, what, those three weirdos who work there?
A little bit about Whale Radio. Gregory Whitehead, radio artist, calls Captain Ahab of Moby Dick fame the first shock jock as the scarred and hobbled lightning-struck captain rants his way through the pages of Moby Dick. Waving his harpoon at the stormy skies, filled with hate for the elusive whale, Ahab is struck by lightning, electrified, his peg leg tapping out a Morse code of vengeance across the deck. Ahab may be a forerunner to the big-mouthed, blasted broadcast radio hosts, who we will not name at this moment, but we can imagine who they are. But what of other pelagic metaphors to be found in this story? For instance, what of the great white whale? The interaction of human with whale in Moby Dick was not one of empathy or mercy, but one of mass slaughter. However, perverse moments of transcendence seem to have taken place on the human side of this most violent communication. The character of Ishmael narrates a famous and particularly tactile episode which takes place when he has been flensing the whales caught on the boat, an encounter with spermaceti, or the material inside the spermaceti organ, which is on the big melon head of sperm whales. And it enables echolocation and sound making in a sperm whale. So it's a gigantic organ filled with the spermaceti material. When flensing and rendering whales into oil upon the whaling ships, whalers had to squeeze the lumps out of the spermaceti, which Ishmael describes as a sweet and unctuous duty, enabling fellowship in close proximity. I will read this little famous passage. I squeezed that sperm till a strange sort of insanity overcame me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-laborers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, affectionate, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget, that I at last was continually squeezing their hands and looking up into their eyes sentimentally, as if to say, oh, my dear fellow beings, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities or know the slightest ill humor or envy? Come, let us squeeze hands all round. Nay, let us squeeze ourselves into each other. Let us squeeze ourselves universally into the very milk and sperm of kindness. So here the whale spermaceti, the actual stuff which allows sperm whales to echolocate and communicate, becomes a medium for human communication. Sadly, Ishmael's profound encounter with humans happens through the body of this slaughtered whale. But what if the whale proposed an alternate understanding of transmission in its own society that is entirely missing from this account? So recent studies of toothed whales and dolphins, let's see if I've got a little whale here, there we go. Toothed whales and dolphins, also known as odontocetes, pretty much all of the current whale research now discusses whales as having culture, as living in societies, as speaking languages and dialects. The brains of humpback whales, dolphins, orcas, sperm whales, and others are especially developed in areas of acoustic processing and communication intelligence. And researchers have been able to observe that they use very complex language, including very distinct dialects among different groups, even living in close proximity to one another. That they pass memories and knowledge on to subsequent generations through communal recollection, that they have self-consciousness, pardon me, complex coalition formation skills, and have been known to use tools. Sound travels more than four times more quickly in water than in air, and water is a particularly excellent medium for long-range transmission of low-frequency sounds. As a result, the use of echolocation and acoustic communication among whales and dolphins holds some surprising parallels to the notions of resonant transmission that I've been discussing with regard to radio. Sperm whale researchers describe being in the water near a group of sperms and feeling the pulses in their bones as they are echolocated from close range by the whales. And so too, dolphin researchers, such as Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff, they write, when a dolphin turns toward you and explores you acoustically with echolocation, you may even feel the buzz of sound waves in your bones and muscles as you reveal more detailed aspects of your physiology to the dolphin by sound waves, more information than the eyes can see. Kind of like a little ultrasound, almost. These researchers speculate that such intimacy among whales enable the tight social formations and more extensive group consciousness that cetaceans exhibit, while long-range echolocation and sound-making allows whales to have an acute spatial sense in their surroundings. Thus, whales would seem to use sonic communications in ways that are physically, socially, and geographically resonant. Says Peter Hoare, it was as if they were resounding miles below, even as they radioed their presence to other whales miles apart. Tuned into some unseen circuit of food and communal intent, they knew instinctively where they were, while we wonder constantly what on earth we are doing. That's regarding sperm whales hunting 2 miles below and making little echolocational sounds. Listening in on hydrophones, researcher Hal Whitehead notes that sperm whales grazing deep underwater keep a constant chorus of clicks. The jumble of clicks of a group of hunting sperms, which together sound like radio static. Sperms also produce recognizable codas, which Whitehead and others understand as signature sounds, dialects, or possibly musical elements involved in whale communication. Orcas, or killer whales, also use backscatter effects from echolocation to distinguish and hunt their favorite Chinook salmon among a school of other salmon. And spinner dolphins communally forage for and trap fish utilizing collective phonation, an ability by a group to sonically navigate as well as converse in low visibility waters with broadband clicks and focus bursts of sound. So really illuminating the landscape of the ocean as a group. In an even stronger and perhaps stranger radiophonic parallel, recent research by a dentist, actually, Martin Nguia, into the nature of narwhal tusks reveals that, the narwhal is this northern sort of small cetacean whale, where for a long time they thought that it was a horn coming out of the forehead of the narwhal, kind of like the unicorn whale, but in fact turns out that the tusk is a tooth that pierces, that grows through the lip, pierces the lip, and grows to be approximately 5 feet long. And they're mainly in the male whales, but some female whales grow these tusks as well. Anyway, for a while there was this idea that the tusk was a jousting tool, the males competing for the females, jousting in the northern seas. Well, of course, it turns out to be nonsense. That, in fact, the tusk is more like an antenna, surprisingly. Unlike other teeth, its surface has open tubules connected to inner nerves. It is, in effect, a giant sense organ, basically a tooth turned inside out with the sensitive part on the outside and the solid, strong part on the inside. It's lined with 10 million nerve endings to enable the animal to detect subtle changes in temperature and pressure. This may explain why narwhals raise their tusks above water as if to sniff the air. Other research indicates that the tusk is not only a sensory probe, but may also be a transmitter or receiver of sound and even of electricity. The narwhal tusk turns out to be, as I said, a tooth turned inside out, with all its sensitive sensing faculties at the surface and the hardest mineralized dentin deposits at the center, producing a spiraling tooth that is strong and flexible, if still mysterious. So whale radio? Are we talking about whale radio? It would seem to be a form of wireless which is both intimate and tactile, and promiscuous at long range. Entirely resonant, requiring the feedback loop of resounding to be meaningful, and requiring everyone in the circuit to both send and receive. Of course, whale radio relies on mechanical, not electromagnetic waves, but remains a really potent example. Could humans develop such capacities in such social life? Or could the example of whale radio temper the ethics of the technologies that we do develop in order to communicate at a distance? Can it challenge what we think communication is for, how long it takes, and what forms it takes?
The notion of ecology typically describes relationships between organisms, opening the category of active agents to more than organisms, allows for ecology also to describe non-living, but material things and systems of things. In this sense, communication systems are part of environments, and environments are also media.
American 1586, contact Toronto Center 1.
Transmission ecologies can refer to both the symbolic spaces of cultural production, like a radio station, and to the invisible and the very material space of dynamic electromagnetic interaction, both of which feature the collaboration between people and things.
That's 1118, this is 6000.
United 1108, Toronto on the way to flight level 250. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tango flight 275, ready to go down.
Eagle flight 274, maintain flight level 240.
Aircraft 1118, there's no restrictions. Descend to 3000 for an 8 mile final.
Roger, no restrictions. 3 mile, 3000.
A transmission ecology could also be defined by the set of radio receivers tuned to a particular station in a single urban area, or by all the activity across the various frequencies on the electromagnetic spectrum that you could sense from one particular location. Radio frequencies are a means of sensing and knowing bodies at a distance. Thinking ecologically demonstrates that transmission and communication is not a game of one-to-many broadcast radiating out from an antenna, nor is it a polarity of senders and receivers, but always a many-to-many field of relationships. Thinking ecologically about transmission considers processes of relationship and power, the dangers of the monocrop, the monopoly, and the logics of the grid. In the organic sense of ecologies, thinking about transmission invites thinking about how seeds travel, like broadcasting, and of the relay networks employed by plants underground. Forests are communal formations with their tree roots connected under the soil in mycorrhizal networks. The very fine root tips of trees join together with microscopic fungal filaments to form the basic links of the network, operating in symbiotic relationships between trees and fungi, allowing hub or mother trees to share nutrients and to communicate with one another with chemical and electrical signals. Trees, like humans, engage in something like wired and wireless communications over distance. The transmission of plants include the root networks underground, or the sensitivity of leaves to sense and scent, and to the casting of seeds. Broadcasting in a radiophonic sense originates from the agricultural term for planting that involves casting seeds broadly at the ground. Seed is no more a container than a radio is. It is not merely tasked with carrying the message of a plant's inheritance to receptive ground. A seed is action over distance. It is a body seeking influence, listening when and where they land, for the circumstances of the ground. The seed encounters good conditions for germination, oxygen, water, temperature, light, and awakens in a gesture that is visually a little like a radio receiver unfolding its antenna. The seed puts out a small root, followed by a tiny stem, sensing and receiving from its environment. From the particularity of a single seed comes not a universal story, but a common one. In each seed resides a generous potential for a plant to germinate, or for a creature to be fed, or for its unrealized germination to become part of the earth. Likewise, radio broadcasting is a remarkable, promiscuous gift of plenitude. Practically, broadcast radio doesn't know who is listening, so the signal is for anyone who cares to. For a listener, the radio is both generally and specifically intended for you. A seed is a possibility for relationships that include the historical, the contemporary, and the imaginary. But seeds spread beyond the fields to which they were originally confined. Likewise, radio signals may also exhibit feral behaviors, find transmissions overlapping or multiplying across the spectrum. Fields may seem the opposite of wilderness, but fields of influence may quickly return to the wild. There are many overlapping ecologies, and the irreducible condition of wirelessness is not space overcome, but it is place multiplied. Waves, fields, roots, seeds.
I know where most people are thinking, oh, it's California. They're crazy. Like, I understand that perspective because I was conservative. And I don't want to bring the politics into this, but I didn't. It already been brought into this.
No, this is not a liberal or a conservative issue, John. This is common sense. When you have a stay-at-home order issued by Democrats and now Governor Santas Florida is going along with it because
the problem is I am just now seeing states shutting down.
Coming up to the majors in 19... by the grace of God.
Thank you.
Come on, how can you watch her? Oh, he's a bear. a chance of rain. The coastal waters forecast from Pigeon Point to Point Pinos. Meanwhile, fewer waters forecast for the following.
O-N-T-O.